Will the new Trump travel ban stand up in court? This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. I'm sitting next to the Attorney General of Washington State and internationally rated chess master, Bob Ferguson. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Bill. Thanks for having me.
How do you rate President Trump's chess game?
I'm not aware that he plays chess, but I'd be happy to take him on if that would resolve the whole travel ban situation.
Is that right?
Winner take all.
Mano a mano, right. Yeah. I've heard people say Trump is playing chess. I've heard he's playing checkers. I've heard Connect Four, so we don't know. Okay, let's talk about your next chess move here. People want to know. You have made, just to catch listeners up, you've been international news since you challenged President Trump's immigrant and refugee ban last month, and you won in court. Now Trump has rewritten that travel ban. Everybody wants to know what you're going to do next. I will save that question until we catch our listeners up on the most important differences between the first travel ban and this new one. Will you run that down in a nutshell?
You bet, in a nutshell, because there are many significant differences. But just to tick through them quickly. So the new executive order, for example, does not apply to individuals who have a green card. That's about 500,000 people in the United States, a lot of folks. Does not apply to folks who already have their visa. You may recall the administration after the first executive order summarily said, hey, even if you have a visa, you can't come to the United States. That impacted tens of thousands of people around the country and in Washington State.
Leading to chaos in people's lives and at the airport.
You read my mind. That's exactly what folks saw on their nightly news night after night. It also does not apply to Iraq. Iraq was one of the seven target countries. They're off the list. It also does not apply, no longer applies a permanent ban on Syrians, refugees from coming into the United States. Now they're treated like others on the new order. And another significant one is that the original order said that if you were a member of a minority religion in one of the seven countries, you had preference to come in. That meant Christians were, frankly, prioritized over Muslims. We had strong disagreements with that. That is now eliminated. So those are some examples of significant changes made from the original order to the new one.
And given all of that, Attorney General, will you file a legal challenge against this executive order?
Yeah, too soon to say. I have a meeting with my team at 2:00 today to walk through potential legal arguments.
Can you move that up to now so you can announce it on KOW?
We can have them call, have my general call right
now. Call in.
Yeah, that'd be good. So I expect a decision by tomorrow or Thursday. Definitely this week is our plan. But, you know, the good news is that the president essentially capitulated on the original executive order. The bad news is there are still significant challenges with the new executive order. The issue I have to resolve is whether or not we think it's unlawful or unconstitutional and that the state of Washington can bring the lawsuit.
Yes. So that's because the state has to have standing. And the question is this ban unconstitutional? What is the number one question, do you think, that upon which it'll hinge whether this is constitutional or not constitutional?
Yeah, so what courts will look like when we say standing, that's just a fancy word for whether or not a party like the state has a dog in the fight. In other words, is there a harm to the state, to the people of the state, that allows me as Attorney General to bring a lawsuit? So what we're literally in the process of doing is what we did 5 weeks ago after we saw the original executive order, which is talking to state colleges and state universities. How are students impacted? How are potential professors who may be coming to those colleges or universities impacted? We're talking to local businesses, entities like Expedia and Amazon, who assisted us on the original litigation in a very profound way, reaching out to them on how are their employees and how is their business impacted. So we have to compile that background to see how the new executive order, frankly, impacts Washingtonians and Washington businesses, and then we can make a decision on whether or not we feel it's the right decision to move forward.
And what have you learned so far? Would you say that universities and the Amazons, Expedias, et cetera, are affected enough? And if so, how would they be affected by this ban?
Can't answer that question yet. That's part of the conversation we were having at 2:00 with the team. The good news is all of those clients, the universities, the colleges, and non-clients like businesses, they've been so responsive from day one, 5 weeks ago, and through the last 24 hours in trying to get us the information we need to make a good decision on behalf of the people.
Is this new Trump executive order a Muslim ban?
Well, that's another question, right? If we have the ability to come into court, if we have standing, then you get to the underlying constitutional issues. And that is one that we had very strong views about for the original executive order. In other words, the president, during his campaign, for example, said, I'm going to have a Muslim ban. Rudy Giuliani, one of his key advisors, not too long ago, said on national TV, hey, the president asked me to create a Muslim ban, just make it lawful. Right. So one thing we sought in our original lawsuit against the original executive order was to seek what was the intent behind this executive order? Is it really a Muslim ban in effect? And so those concerns remain. They have changed the countries. They've dropped Iraq, but six of the seven countries still remain And those are questions we'll be answering here in the next 48 hours.
You're listening to Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who's joining us live now in the studio. And, of course, he is the Attorney General who successfully challenged President Trump's original executive order, his travel ban. How can this be a Muslim ban if most Muslims are still welcome from Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, now Iraq, and most other majority Muslim countries?
Sure. So you can have an order or a law that is discriminatory, even if it does not discriminate against everybody in a class. So in other words, you can discriminate against a subset of African Americans, even if you are not discriminating against all of them. That's still unlawful, right? So taking that a step further, the document itself can appear on its face to be lawful. You may not be calling out anyone specifically, but that gets to the motivation behind it. You can have a document that looks on its face to be lawful, but when you look at the motivation of what caused that document to be created, you can sometimes see that is discrimination in play. And that's not unique to this case. That's very common in cases of all kinds around the country.
But isn't there evidence that President Trump's motivations have changed since those original comments? Maybe he's learned that Muslim bans are unconstitutional, so he's trying something different.
That is, of course, always possible, and that'd be part of what, if we go forward with the lawsuit, what we'd be getting at. What is the truth behind the intent of that? That said, there is already plenty of evidence based on his own statements. I mean, it's unusual to have that much evidence before you even get to discovery, where you're seeking emails and taking depositions and getting documents. We're not even at that stage yet, but already just the statements from the president and his advisors gave us great concern and was a big reason why we filed that original lawsuit against the president.
You called the president's first travel ban, and I think the second one, immoral, didn't you? Why immoral?
Yeah, it's, you know, I have deep frustrations with the current president on many policy issues, this being one of them. And look, we are a nation of immigrants, and to target refugees who are trying to flee a war-torn country like Syria and come to a place like the United States, hey, our country was founded on those principles of immigration. And so that's in part why I find it so troubling. And moreover, and back to our original lawsuit, we had multiple national security experts, both Democratic and Republican, saying this travel ban is actually harmful to national security. That includes the CIA director for George W. Bush, right? That's a bipartisan group. So it's immoral, but also it's doing more harm than good. Now, those are policy differences.
Yes.
The key thing I need to determine as the attorney general is whether or not it's illegal.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you then, why are you even talking about its morality?
Well, because you asked me the question, right?
Well,
you're hoping I was forgetting you'd ask me that, right?
But I think you've already called these travel bans immoral. And I ask because, for example, today there was a New York Times piece by self-described liberal James Traub, who says, when liberals pretend there are no costs to immigration and no risks, then voters who don't buy that give us Donald Trump, who they see as a truth teller. What do you think of that?
Yeah, look, it's what's truth telling is what the courts determine. And four federal judges, two appointed by Democrats, two appointed by Republican presidents, completely rejected every argument that President Trump's lawyers put before them. It just shut them down completely. And there's a reason why President Trump changed his executive order dramatically, because he knew he would continue to lose. So look, what I'm focused on as Attorney General is this document and whether or not it's lawful or unconstitutional. That's the focus. That's the truth for me.
We're talking with Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson, and we have a question for you from a listener about your decision to sue the Trump administration over the first travel ban. As I said, you were a figure of international news.
Hi, Attorney General Ferguson. This is Shelley Green from Renton, Washington. I'm hoping you can describe how you decided to become the one to take up the fight against the Muslim ban and what you think stopped other attorneys general from taking up the same kind of leadership against it. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Why you?
Well, thanks to Shelley for that question. I'm not sure there's a short answer, but I'll do my best. I think it's a combination of factors. Number one, as a team in our office, we had been thinking about the president. We'd anticipated the president taking this action. He'd promised it during the campaign, on the campaign trail, and I kind of took him at his word that he really would do it. So I think, number one, we were not caught by surprise. That's number one. Number two, we'd spoken about when the order came down, which we felt was inevitable. We put in place a team that could go to work immediately on that executive order. And that's what happened. It was signed on a Friday night. By Saturday morning, folks were in my office working all weekend, and I joined them doing that work to get ready to see if we had a strong case. And thirdly, I think what held some folks back was, look, there's a risk in suing the president of the United States. A lot of folks did not think legal experts, you know, on CNN, frankly, were unpersuaded when I first went on to talk about our case. But the courts, I think our lawsuit proved them wrong. The courts agreed with us. So there's always an element of risk, and it's a high-profile risk. If you go to the trial court judge and he shuts you down in short order, you know, it's not a good day at the office. So it's ouch. And so there's an element of risk, but I've always been comfortable with taking calculated risk, and I felt very strongly that it was unconstitutional, and I felt very confident in my team that we would persuade the courts.
One more question about the travel ban. Yeah. Do you think this is not immediate? It takes effect on March 16th. Do you think there'll be any SeaTac airport chaos?
Well, it's possible, right? And I certainly hope that doesn't happen. But that is absolutely possible. We'll have to see how things develop in the coming days, whether litigation continues, whether the temporary restraining order remains in place. All sorts of big questions will sort themselves out in the next week. That's a better time probably to answer that question then.
Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson joining us live here on KUOW Seattle. I want to ask you about pot, because the Trump White House has hinted that it might crack down on recreational marijuana use in Washington and other states where pot is, quote, legal, but kind of not. You said you will use every tool at your disposal to save Washington's pot regulation system. What tools do you have?
Well, we're the largest law firm in the state of Washington, and our responsibility is to defend and uphold the will of the people. The voters voted for marijuana legalization, so frankly, it's my job responsibility to do whatever I can to uphold that. So I've reached out to the new attorney general, requesting a meeting to talk about marijuana legalization here in Washington State. The governor
is that meeting set with Jeff Sessions?
Has not been set yet, and we just sent that letter a couple weeks ago. The governor joined me in that letter. So in the same way we met with Eric Holder, then Attorney General under Barack Obama, back in 2013 after the governor and I were first elected to talk about marijuana, it's the same request here. We want to talk about what we're doing in Washington, and my message will be the same that it was with Eric Holder, which is, look, if the federal government chooses to try and crack down on the legalization here in Washington State, I will resist that and use the tools that we have.
I still don't know how. If the federal government, it may be legal on a state level, but if the federal government wants to crack down on banks, retailers, growers, how could they not do that?
Well, there's a very complex body of law known as preemption, right? In other words, how can a state, for example, preempt or trump a local jurisdiction and force them to do something or not do something? The same applies for the federal government in its relationship with the states. It's a complex area, but that would be a question that we would want ultimately be determined in the courts. So we would fight it legally in the courts.
Another question for Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson. You've proposed a statewide ban on some semi-automatic guns and high-capacity magazines. And John wants to know, why do you react with a knee-jerk style to AR-style weapons when few homicides are committed with such weapons? The magazine ban isn't going to stop individuals who already have them, and they're easily obtainable in neighboring states.
Yeah, I disagree. I guess a couple thoughts. First, a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, look, this was something we spent many, many months thinking about. Number two, it's a ban on the sale of assault weapons, which, by the way, it's worth pointing out, an 18-year-old can walk into a store and walk out with an assault weapons. No background check done by law enforcement, no waiting period, but you have to be 21 to buy a handgun, and there's a waiting period while law enforcement does a background check. That makes no sense. We are proposing a limit on high-capacity magazines to 10 rounds. Currently, there is no limit whatsoever on high-capacity magazines. And I think if you ever have a chance to speak to the parents of the victims of the Mukilteo shooting, the teenagers who were killed there, I invite the listener to listen what those folks have to say about the damage that high-capacity magazines can do and assault weapons can do.
But this will not pass in the state legislature now, right?
It's not passing this year, but you know, this is one of those issues where the people are ahead of the politicians. And I get why politicians are cautious, right? Any change to gun laws, look, you bring the gun lobby, you know, the wrath of the gun lobby upon you. But polls make it very clear. These are common sense gun reforms that have passed in other states and been upheld by numerous federal courts of appeals. They're constitutional. And I think it's a matter of time before our state legislature recognizes that.
Another subject for Washington's Attorney General, Bob Ferguson. Car tab fees are rising. Some people are shocked by how much their fees are going up since voters passed the Sound Transit 3 package. Two state senators have asked you for your opinion on whether the car tab mechanism is unconstitutional. What do you think so far?
So we'll be talking to the team about that. I'm aware of that request. Just so your listeners know, as the Attorney General, we can provide legal guidance to the legislature, for example, on topics. We do not provide that guidance, though, when, for example, there's litigation around the question. And also, if it's asking about the constitutionality of a state statute, we have to be a little bit careful because our job, of course, is to defend state law. And so for us to give an opinion that might say it's unconstitutional presents a problem for us. Those are longstanding policies we've had over many AGs in the state of Washington. So we'll take a look at it, and if we can respond to it, we will. That's what we do. But if we feel it that we cannot, then we would be unable to do so. But we recognize it's an important issue and one we're taking a look at.
That's car tab fees. Let's talk about the EPA and President Trump. Bob wants to know, with the EPA being dismantled, as Bob puts it, what can you do as Attorney General to protect the air, land, and waters of not only Puget Sound, but the whole Pacific Northwest region?
Yeah, it's a good question. In fact, I had a meeting just earlier today with some members of my team, and we're looking at signing letters with other AGs about big changes with the Clean Power Plan, for example, changes with the EPA. So one thing I can do is use my bully pulpit, number one. Number two, if something is a policy change but is legal, well, hey, that's where your members of Congress come in, right? But if it's illegal or unconstitutional, that's where your attorney general can make a difference, as we saw with the travel ban or as we might see with marijuana, right? So part of it is me being aware of what my role is. I can use my bully pulpit if I disagree on a policy level, but where I really can get particularly engaged is if it's actually an unlawful action.
Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson, you just mentioned your bully pulpit ability to influence what happens with the EPA and environment cleanup. You would have a much bigger bully pulpit if you were governor of Washington State. When will you be running for governor?
My wife better not.
And if I could ask a follow-up, when will you be running for president of the United States?
Yeah, so it's, look, my wife and I, Colleen and I, we have young kids. They just turned 9. They're twins. And you've got a young child, at least one. And so, look, that's time with the family is important. And the work I'm doing, look, I often say the most important job in government is being attorney general. And people, Bill, would give me a funny look when I used to say that. They don't give me a funny look anymore. In light of the travel ban and the work we're doing there, I think folks realize how critical the role of attorney general is in our form of government. And I'm enjoying that role right now.
Washington's attorney general, Bob Ferguson, knows about my 6-year-old kid because my kid is an aspiring chess master, right. And you were a state champion, or at least
a long time ago. I twice won the state championship. Yeah.
Wow. How about that? You have a picture of Bobby Fischer in your office. I understand.
I do. My team rolls their eyes, but I'm always giving them chess analogies to the work that we do. So chess was a very formative part of my life. I spent time playing in Europe internationally, and so it was a big part of my life.
Yeah. So what do you do with President Trump? Do you castle now? Do you do a timing move? Do you try to control the center of the board?
I think back to your earlier question about why, or the listener's question about why we were able to get out first. In part, it's you anticipate your opponent's moves. That's what chess teaches you. And so, frankly, I do think there's some analogies there that I was thinking about what is the president going to do, and let's be ready to meet that if it comes. And I think there is some element of that background in chess that, frankly, does help me in the work that I do now.
Will you teach my child?
I would love to sit down with your child and have him beat me at a game of chess. That'd be great.
Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson, the big question, of course, will he legally challenge President Trump's new travel ban? And your answer was you have another meeting at 2 o'clock today, maybe an announcement this week?
I think almost certainly this week. I don't want to be absolute, but we're planning on moving as quickly as we can, but we need to be thoughtful about it.
AG Bob Ferguson, thanks for joining us live on KUOW.
Thanks, Bill. Really appreciate it.
Talking about immigration now on KUOW, you know, Seattle has the third biggest Somali population in America. Many of them came here as refugees. Some of them still have family living in refugee camps overseas. The president's new travel ban stops those family members from entering the U.S. for at least 4 months. KUOW's Kate Walters traveled to the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya to see how Trump's immigration policies are affecting people waiting to come to the U.S.
Mohammed Abdi has lived in Dadaab for over 25 years. It's the largest refugee camp in the world, home to more than 265,000 people. Most of them, like Abdi, are from Somalia. I sat down with him in a small tea shop in the camp, and he told me it's an unforgiving place where there's never enough.
If it's food, if it's medicine, it's not enough for a family to survive, because the life here is very harsh, very harsh.
Bare red dirt stretches for miles, coating everything in a fine layer of dust. The heat weighs on you. People seek relief in the structures they've built out of mud and sacks emblazoned with the UN logos, faded by the sun. Abdi's been watching people leave the camp for 2 decades, including his childhood friend who came to Seattle, all the time wondering when his turn would come, when he could take his wife and his 2 young children to resettle in the US. His hope is to work as a nurse in America, like he does in the camp. but it's not so easy. The vetting process for resettlement is intense.
Like me, I went to my first interview in 2010. The second interview was 2016.
The Trump administration says this vetting process is not good enough, particularly for countries like Somalia with terrorist links. Trump wants to see a more rigorous system in place. For Abdi, that stance has been a huge blow to his hope and morale. He says he can't go back to Somalia and he's tired of waiting.
Waiting very long time, and then if the president says that we will ban this from entering the United States, it will harm us. Because the only hope that we have is to go to resettlement, to live better life, and also to get a better education than this one.
After the first ban, many resettlement cases like Abdi's were put on hold. Gino Tiafolo is with the Norwegian Refugee Council. It's one of the humanitarian groups working in Dadaab. He says the Trump administration's approach to immigration has been disillusioning for refugees.
These refugees are people. They deserve better. They are not ping pong balls who should be knocked back and forth between being allowed to resettle in the USA and not.
In Dadaab, it feels like the US door has been closed. And that's contributed to an increase in the number of people going back to Somalia. Each person gets $200 from the United Nations to help them start over at home. On any given day, hundreds of people line up to board these colourful buses that will take them back across the border. They're giving up refugee status to take their chances with political instability and drought. Sahan Abdikarane is one of the people taking her family home. Speaking through a translator, she tells me why.
Given that resettlement has been stopped because of the executive order in America, and the hope that we had is the world to kind of take us on board in one of their countries. Given that that's happened, as well as the election of a new president in Somalia, we are happy to go back.
I'm surprised she uses the word happy, but after 14 years in the camp, Karane says she's done waiting. Still, her decision to go home means she's splitting up her family. One of Karane's children is remaining behind in the camp to finish his education.
Because the government is not established right now and there are no public schools, so I don't want to cut his education short because he's about to complete.
If America would take them, she says, they wouldn't have to be separated. But separation of families is part of life as a refugee. Multiple Somali families living in Seattle are waiting for relatives still stuck in Dadaab. After this second travel ban from the Trump administration, it's unknown how long that wait will last. From Dadaab Refugee Camp, Kenya, I'm Kate Walters, KUOW News.
And you'll hear more from our series In Limbo tomorrow on KUOW Seattle. The fast growth we're having in this region is straining our lakes, especially the little lakes on the fringes of urban areas. When growth approaches, the communities around them are not always prepared to protect those lakes from pollution. KUOW's Region of Boom team has been hanging out in Black Diamond because it's the future site of King County's biggest housing development. That is how reporter Joshua McNichols heard the curious story of Lake Sawyer's Weir Master.
The water level of Lake Sawyer in Black Diamond is controlled by a weir, a small dam built back in the 1950s. It has a rinky-dink little fish ladder and a board that you can take out to lower the lake. And somebody has to take care of it.
So there's like a weir master? What is a weir master?
I think the weir master is a technical word for the person who takes the board out of the weir. It's very unique. It's very particular.
That's Andy Williamson, who works for the city of Black Diamond. I told him I wanted to meet this mysterious individual.
Do you know the Weir Master personally? Do you know who it is, and do you know that person?
I knew who the Weir Master used to be, but that person has retired and moved to Arizona, so I don't know who currently is the Weir Master.
But he did have a lead. The guys who live on either side of the weir is on their property. So in a way, they're responsible for it. I traveled there by boat. Lake Sawyer residents Cindy and Bill Wheeler rode me there. On the way over, Cindy told me how Bill courted her on this lake.
And I said, I don't know how to water ski. He said, I'd be happy to teach you.
30 years later, they're both still living on Lake Sawyer.
This lake means so much to us.
But they don't know the Weir Master. Our boat arrived at the dam.
Hey.
Kenny Dooley waved us over from the shore.
That's heck do you guys end up out here?
Half of the weir is on his property.
No. Would you call yourself the weir master?
No, I wouldn't, no.
Dooley told me when he bought this property in 1996, the deed didn't say anything about the weir or his responsibility for it.
The people that I bought the place from, you know, I was told that he pretty much maintained this.
The weir?
Yeah, so he pretty much maintained it. And I just thought it was just, you know, out of the kindness of his heart type deal. But now that come to find out, it wasn't that way.
A few years ago, he learned from the state that if the dam breaks, he has to fix it. Randy Payne lives on the other side.
Are you the weir master?
I don't think so. There's been rumors of one, but I've never had anybody introduce himself or anything like that.
Payne said he got a binder from the state detailing his responsibility for the weir. He can't remember what it said.
I mean, I'm not sure where it is. I could try to find it, but yeah. I don't know. I'm not positive where it is. So.
Cindy Wheeler wasn't surprised.
There isn't a weir master of Lake Sawyer. There's been no entity or individual who has been assigned or identified as the weir master ever since the city of Black Diamond annexed this lake 20 plus years ago.
On our way back across the lake, Cindy Wheeler told me the weir master, or rather the lack of one, is a symbol of a larger problem. She said no level of government has demonstrated enough commitment to protect this lake.
Fish and Wildlife, King County, Department of Ecology, and the City of Black Diamond are all stakeholders in this lake. They certainly all collect tax dollars from this waterfront district, and they need to have a comprehensive plan that manages everything.
But she said they don't. She said that's especially important with the 6,000 home development being built in Lake Sawyer's watershed. Wheeler rode me to a stream that empties into Lake Sawyer. It flows near part of the future development. Wheeler said by the time we detect this development's impact on the lake, it'll be too late.
But it makes me mad. We may well harm and kill this resource before anybody gets to enjoy what it once could have been.
But the developer doesn't want to see the lake destroyed either. Colin Lund is Oak Point's development director. He said any rain that falls on the new development will be sent back into the ground where the water can be cleansed by the soil. He said the law forbids the project from adding pollution to the lake.
We were required to do low-impact development techniques, so we've really taken that to heart. And if you were on site today, you would see that we've installed several rain gardens, which is really kind of the natural way of taking care of stormwater, to basically infiltrate the water back in the ground, kind of where it fell, if you will.
Lund said this development will go beyond the legal requirements for cleaning the rainwater. Oak Point plans to make those water-filtering rain gardens a prominent feature in the landscape so that people can see them in action during a rainstorm.
We're not trying to hide the fact that we're doing, you know, low-impact development, but we're celebrating it. We're putting it right up front.
Black Diamond's residents are split on whether to trust the developer's promises to control pollution. Cindy Wheeler didn't, and she hired some expert help.
I'm Rob Zizet with Herrera Environmental Consultants, and I'm a water quality specialist and a senior limnologist.
Limnologist? What does that mean?
Study of lakes.
Zizet works on some well-known lakes. He advises Seattle on how to manage Green Lake, for example. He said when he got out of college, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency used to shell out a lot of money to study and restore lakes.
But those funds have been cut. The focus now is on salmon in streams, and lakes do not have a funding source.
He said today, the burden of maintaining lakes falls mostly on the homeowners who live on them.
Everybody who lives around a lake, people figure they're rich, they can afford to manage their lake, it's their problem. That's why they're not giving them money, because they're a bunch of rich lake homeowners. So they're left with the burden.
But lake management is really expensive, so many lakes go unmanaged. They begin to lose their oxygen. They develop toxic algae blooms. And when lakes decline too far, their problems flow downstream and create larger problems in Puget Sound. In Black Diamond, there's a small budget for monitoring Lake Sawyer, but the developer's plan to filter pollutants out of the stormwater there is ambitious. Zizet said the developer's work must be monitored very closely. He said it's going to take more than a weir master to protect this lake. In Black Diamond, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
You're listening to KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. So glad to have you with us today. You know, if there's one thing the internet has plenty of, it is arguments. People passionately debating in long threads about politics, economics, science. You might be arguing right now over Facebook or Twitter while you're listening. But how much do you actually know about almost anything? Probably not as much as you think, says cognitive scientist Philip Fernback, co-author of the new book, The Knowledge Illusion. Fernback says, we think we know more than we do, from economic theory to the way a toilet works. And there's a name for this phenomenon, the illusion of explanatory depth.
We tend to see the world as much more simple than it actually is. We overestimate how well we understand things. And initially, this was studied with things like zippers and can openers and stuff like that. And I got interested in this because I think it's such a pervasive and important phenomenon that really drives so much of our behavior and our decisions.
What about zippers and can openers?
Take almost anything you can think of and try to explain it. And what you'll find is that you don't know quite as much as you initially might have thought that you did. So we use the example in the book of a toilet. If you ask people whether they know how a toilet works, most people will say, yeah, I kind of know how it works. I have a pretty good sense of that. And then if you ask them to explain, they start talking and not much comes out. that's sort of the nature of the way our minds work.
We've all lived full lives where surely we've had plenty of time to realize how little we know. Why would we not know what we know?
The real problem is that we tend not to know what we don't know. So we focus a lot on what we do know. And the world is really complex. Even things that seem simple have layers of complexity to them. And so we cope with all of that complexity by kind of forgetting how complicated things are. Young kids realize this. If you've got young kids at home, they're always asking why. Mm-hmm. And as a parent, you usually reach the point at which you say because you can't go down another level because you can't really explain at a deeper level. But as adults, we cope with all of that complexity by forgetting about how complex things are.
We spend so much time trying to be right. But you're saying we're not really built to be that right, not as individuals. We're just not supposed to know that much.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the main ideas that we talk about throughout the book is the way that the mind is really designed to work with other minds. What we are really good at as human beings is collaborating with one another to achieve complex goals. So no other animals can even come close to doing anything remotely like what humans can when it comes to collaborating with others and specializing and sharing knowledge and all that kind of stuff. That's really what the mind is made to do. It's not to store all of the details in one mind. That's just not practical. There's just too much to know.
So zippers and can openers, yeah, I don't really understand how they work, but to put it into the political realm, which we're all arguing about so much, I don't have to understand how the deportation process works to have an okay opinion on immigration, do I?
Almost any political issue is sufficiently complex that no one individual can master all the details. And yet we still have to have beliefs and positions about things. What we lament in the book is the extent of the extremity and the polarization that sometimes occurs because people fail to realize that they don't understand things deeply. So I think we would not argue that nobody should have an opinion without knowing everything about an issue. But we should be a little more humble about the extent to which we understand things before expressing really strong opinions.
If when we talk politics, we were more aware of how little we knew, how would that be a better world?
So many issues that there are issues where the two sides have sort of incontrovertible differences in their values. But there's plenty of issues that we argue about all the time where both sides kind of want to accomplish the same goals. And we might disagree on exactly how we get there. But the fact that we tend to absorb the world in such a simplistic manner a lot of the time might lead us to assume that the differences are more stark between the two sides. A lot of policy issues are quite complex in terms of what the inputs and outputs are and how the inputs lead to the outputs and so on. And so it's very easy to say the other side is wrong, the other side is stupid, the other side is evil. But if we sit down and actually talk through the mechanics of stuff and realize that we don't have all of the details, we might come to realize that actually we're not so far apart.
Does your understanding as a cognitive scientist help us deal with claims that we don't know how to evaluate? I'm thinking of President Trump saying that millions of undocumented immigrants swayed the election vote by voting illegally. And I'm thinking about vaccines cause autism. There are all kinds of claims out there that we don't really know what to do with, but some of us feel like we know.
We have to be able to investigate these kind of things and rely on experts and have good sources of expertise that we can trust. You and I individually are not equipped to figure out whether there's actual voter fraud, but what we can do is go to credible sources. The challenge is that on the different sides, people draw on different sources, and there's been sort of a diffusion in terms of credibility and who we go to for the right kind of information. And so if you don't trust the credible sources, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble. And by virtue of some of us believing it, other people in our community will tend to believe it. So it's almost like a house of cards that can develop.
Okay, so let's say you are arguing with someone who you think might not know much. What's the most constructive way to get through to them, to build something?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one thing is, the first thing you don't want to do is make somebody else feel stupid, because then they get defensive. And I think a lot of times when we're arguing with somebody who has a different perspective than us, that is sort of our first instinct as human beings, unfortunately. And defensiveness and negativity sort of breed defensiveness and negativity. So you need to find a way to sort of productively come together and discuss the mechanics. Do the two of us understand how this policy might be implemented or how it might work in order to actually justify the things that we're arguing about? If not, maybe we can both go off and do some research and come to a deeper understanding. In my experience, that kind of mechanistic or mechanical discussion about the way things work is more effective at fostering productive debate than is the typical, I'm right, you're wrong kind of disputes.
I like that. Put the two of us on the same side, which is the, man, how do we figure this out together?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great way of thinking about it. On the same side, both in pursuit of the truth. We tend to think in terms of caricatures. And when you actually sit down and talk to somebody, not always. There are people out there who are a little bit on the extremes, but typically you'll find that the caricature is not that accurate.
What has your research done to your own ideas about how much knowledge you have? How do you go through life differently because of what you've learned?
This is probably the project I've worked on in my career that's had the most sort of personal impact on me. And I catch myself all the time wanting to pop off about something that I don't understand in detail. And I've slowed that down, you know. I do sort of reflect more on where my attitudes and my positions are coming from. And I think it's led me to be a little bit more humble in the way that I go about interacting with the world. I will say that, you know, we focus quite a bit on the book about some of the problems and overconfidence that this can lead to. But there's also some virtue in being overconfident when it comes to your understanding. A lot of us wouldn't get much accomplished unless we sort of jumped into stuff that we weren't equipped to jump into. And we usually find a way through it. So the kind of effects that I'm talking about are not all bad, for sure.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you, why do I so want to pop off, even though I don't know what I'm talking about? That's adaptive in some way, or it's
helpful?
Yeah,
I think so. I think it can certainly be adaptive. There's actually another book by a couple of cognitive scientists talking about what the purpose of thinking is for, what reason is for, and they argue that it's not really to arrive at the truth. It's to be able to argue and to advocate for our positions. That's sort of an evolutionary argument that I think has some truth to it.
And Philip, how does a toilet work?
That's a great question. Check out my book, Chapter 1. It's right there for you.
And that book that will tell you how a toilet works and why you probably don't actually know is called The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. Our guest, Philip Fernback, is the co-author. And if you really want to go deep on why we all assume we know more than we actually do, Professor Fernback mentioned another book by two social scientists. That is called The Enigma of Reason. And we're tweeting out a link to pieces about both of those books. Right now, we are at KUOW. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. What can President Trump's opponents learn from the Tea Party? There's a group on the political left that, among other things, has been organizing protests at town hall meetings that members of Congress hold. Sometimes those Congress members don't hold town hall meetings because they don't want to face the agitators. This group is called Indivisible. Its board members have said they're emulating what the conservative Tea Party organizers did in 2009 when they opposed President Obama's policies. In our studio now, we have the group's executive director, Ezra Levin. Hi, Ezra.
Hey, great to be here.
And someone I believe you know. On the phone is Tea Party organizer, executive director of the Tea Party Express, Taylor Butterwich. Hi, Taylor.
Hey, Bill. Hey, Ezra.
Hey, Taylor. Great to hear you again.
Yes, definitely.
Ezra is on your mailing list, I understand, Taylor.
I think that's right.
we're BFFs at this point.
You're BFFs. First of all, Ezra, with the progressive group Indivisible, what about the Tea Party are you emulating?
Yeah, so Indivisible Project is very explicitly inspired by key components of the Tea Party. We put out a Google Doc all of 10 weeks ago that said that, look, we disagreed with the Tea Party's ideology, we didn't like their policies, but we thought they got strategies really right, and they implemented those strategies with smart civics 101 tactics. So that is a local defensive congressional advocacy strategy that we think can be really effective right now for the progressive movement.
What do you mean defensive?
It means that right now, and it's a hard truth, progressives do not have the House, the Senate, or the presidency. That means we lack the agenda-setting power. Instead, what we have is the power to respond. The Tea Party got that. In 2009, they didn't have the House, the Senate, or the presidency, but they knew how to respond to the agenda coming down from President Obama and Congress. So we think that that is a smart move, and not just because it's strategically important. As a former congressional staffer, I think that's a good strategic play, but I actually think we have a moral responsibility right now because this president and this Congress is attacking the most vulnerable members of society.
One more question for you before we go to Taylor. Ezra Levin with the Indivisible Project, the chair of the Washington State Republican Party says that you are bullying lawmakers into backing off from the policies that President Trump and the Republicans are advocating. You're going to town halls, you're shouting people down, you're bullying.
Yeah. It's funny here because I'm not doing anything. There are 233 Indivisible groups in Washington state, and these are made up of school teachers and nurses and folks with everyday jobs. And you know what they have in common? They're concerned about the state of the country and where we're headed. So they are standing up, they're getting civically engaged. Some of them aren't even Democrats. Some of them are independents or Republicans who are also scared about the direction the country is headed. And so what they're doing is they're going to town halls or they're going to public events and they're making their voices heard. So if a member of Congress doesn't like that, they should get a new job because representing your constituents is part of the job description.
As I said, on the phone is the head of the Tea Party Express, Taylor Butterwich. Taylor, how well is Indivisible copying your Tea Party playbook?
Well, I think they're definitely getting the protests, the rallies, the town halls right. But that wasn't invented by the Tea Party movement. So campaign tactics like that have been around for decades. The difference between the Tea Party, and I would even say the Tea Party didn't even exceed at stopping the Obama's legislation, at least in the first 2 years. But the difference was, and what I don't think the movement on the left has understood yet, is what we finally figured out was in order to change the policies, you have to change the players. And that's why we engage directly in elections. For instance, we were protesting in 2009 prior to Obamacare being passed in December of 2009 on Christmas Eve. We didn't stop that from happening. It wasn't until actually yesterday that we've had a viable path to repealing and replacing Obamacare. But we achieved that by having historical electoral success at the ballot box. And like Ezra pointed out, having control of both chambers of Congress and the White House is definitely an important key to realizing policy changes.
So you've got the Affordable Care Act now. Repeal and replace is happening. How much does President Trump align with your Tea Party goals?
Well, I think right now, and what we've seen, I was very excited by the speech he gave on Tuesday night, like a lot, like 70 or 80% of Americans, according to the CNN and CBS poll, were very excited about what he said on Tuesday night. We're in desperate need, and he's right on the line of reining in government, addressing the economic growth, which has been stagnant in the past 8 years, and tackling the big ticket issues that I think the Tea Party movement has championed over the past 8 years or so.
Okay, Ezra, you heard the key difference, according to Taylor from the Tea Party Express, is they focused on elections, 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 changing the people, the players. What's the evidence that's happening on your side?
Yeah, so, I mean, I totally take Taylor's point, and I think that's a key strategy as well. That's not where they started. And I think he's absolutely right. The Tea Party didn't succeed all the time. Obamacare passed. Dodd-Frank passed.
Stimulus package passed.
But they were still able to slow down the mechanics of government and in some cases defeat key components of the agenda. That's step one, and that's important on its own. So defeating the repeal of Obamacare for this movement is important on its own because 32 million Americans are going to lose their health insurance with that. But I also think Taylor is right, that that's not the only way to affect policy change. And a key other step is, what are you going to do electorally? How are you going to change the people making decisions? I would tell you, look at Georgia 6. That's an election coming up, an open election for Congress in a congressional district that Trump won by 1%. I think we should all pay attention to that.
How are you different from the Tea Party, Ezra? At Indivisible Project.
Well, so I think we're different in that we model progressive values, that we believe that you should form an inclusive group, and that we believe that government can be a force for good in the country. But I would also say, as a movement, it is larger, it is faster, it is better organized than the Tea Party ever was. You saw just in the day after President Trump's inauguration, enormous protests nationwide. And today we have over 6,000 groups that have registered across the country, two in every single congressional district in the country. At this time in President Obama's presidency, the Tea Party was a blip. It hadn't actually come together yet. So I have just been inspired by how this movement has caught fire over the last several weeks.
Ezra Levin with the progressive group, the Indivisible Project. Yes.
And can I just say, we have an event tonight.
Oh, yes. Town Hall Seattle.
6:30 p.m. tonight, Town Hall Seattle. It's free if you're a student, $5 if you want to get in. And that doesn't go to me. That goes to a local immigrant rights organization.
And on the phone with us on KUOW, Executive Director of the Tea Party Express, Taylor Butterwich. Ezra just called your group, by implication, not inclusive, not a force for good, and by the way, not that well organized.
Yeah, I think Ezra actually hit on the main difference between the Tea Party and his movement, or the movement that he's a part of, and that's, we didn't have the support of the party infrastructure. We were much different than the Republican Party, it was voters that weren't feeling like they were being represented, and so that was the difference, and we haven't seen that. So, and we look back, you know, the question's been asked of, what tactics should the left use and emulate from the right? But what's being missed in that, and the inherent bias, is that the Tea Party was successful because of the issues it espoused, that it had a broad support across the country. By kind of doubling down on the same rhetoric and same policies of the past administration and the party that is being represented in the Democratic Party, I don't see how you can have electoral success, given that it's failed so historically, election cycle after election cycle, for the past 8 years. So there has to be a differentiation between what is the Democratic Party and what is this movement, because right now it looks one and the same, and that's a losing proposition.
Ezra, is the Indivisible Project just the Democratic Party?
Yeah, so absolutely not. And it's something I really respect about the early Tea Party, at least, that they kept at arm's length away the RNC, the Republican Party. I think that was smart.
Where do you disagree with the Democratic Party?
Oh, well, so, I mean, we think, for instance, 15 Democrats voted for Mike Pompeo for CIA director, a man who endorses widespread surveillance of Americans, who slanders Muslim Americans, who's open to torture. We definitely disagree with that. What we saw from the movement was people outside of Dianne Feinstein's office in California, or Chuck Schumer's office in Manhattan, or Amy Klobuchar's office in Minneapolis, saying, why are you voting for this nominee? 2 weeks later, zero Democrats voted for Betsy DeVos, the nominee for education secretary. And it's not because Betsy DeVos is so much worse than Mike Pompeo was. She's bad, but don't get me wrong. She doesn't endorse torture, as far as I know. The difference was, in those 2 weeks, people made their voices heard through this movement, through the movement of the resistance on the ground. That's part of the game plan. And I will say, the Tea Party did that pretty well on the Republican side. We are not an arm of the Democratic Party. We view ourselves as something distinct.
Taylor, does that sound like as big a split between Indivisible and the Democrats as you were facing with the Republicans?
Well, if Ezra's correct in that, analysis, then they're going to have a primary challenge up in Montana against John Tester, who supports the Keystone XL pipeline, or Joe Donnelly in Indiana, or Joe Manchin in West Virginia, who's been palling around with President Trump, who they disagree so strongly with. So if that's true, then we're going to be seeing a lot of Democratic primaries. But I don't see how their issue matrix as it stands right now will be successful in Montana, West Virginia, or Indiana, or in Kansas 4, where the Pompeo district that he just referenced. And so, you know, I understand where he's coming from, but it's going to be hard to replicate the Tea Party's success electorally with ideas and progressive policies that are so far out of the mainstream.
Let's talk about a local member of Congress, Dave Reichert. Mm-hmm. Was it fair to say you're targeting him?
Well, I'm not doing anything. I can't talk about what his constituents are doing. I will say that he sits on the Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives. The Ways and Means Committee, which is the Tax Writing Committee, has the unilateral ability to get Trump's tax returns. Now, I don't know if Trump is engaging in a cover-up with respect to Russia or his business conflict.
He told us you can't call on an individual's tax returns.
That is so interesting because, in fact, there is a 93-year-old bill that gives him exactly that ability to do, to rein in conflicts of interest. In the executive branch, it was used on a sitting president, President Trump, and it was used by Republicans 2.5 years ago to get the tax information of 51 organizations that they released publicly. He has that ability. He is what's standing between us and Trump's tax returns, along with his Republican colleagues.
That's Western Washington, mostly Western, Republican Congressman Dave Reichert. Finally, before we close, I'll ask each of you about a presidential candidate. Who's your ideal indivisible presidential candidate? So, and would it be the same as the Democrats are going to nominate?
Well, we stand for resisting the Trump agenda in all its forms and its attack on not just progressive values, but on basic tenets of American democracy. So we're fighting the battles now around legislation. Electoral is often in the future.
Okay. 1 minute left. Taylor, what suggestion do you have for Ezra, your progressive colleague, your BFF, as you said?
Well, I think you need to answer your question. I think that's like a key component because I don't know what the indivisible movement stands for other than being against Trump. And that's a key difference between what the Tea Party movement did is we were against the President Obama's agenda. But also we had an agenda of our own that we were willing to articulate, and I would have been willing to answer your question this time.
Ezra, we're out of time. I know that, Taylor, we're out of time. Ezra would love to answer that. That's Taylor Butterwich from the Tea Party Express.
I'll look for a tweet from him.
Yes. You got 5 seconds.
We stand for protection of the old, the sick, the young, the poor, the immigrants, the Muslims, the people who are under attack.
Ezra
Levin,
thank you for that. Town Hall, Seattle. 6:30
p.m.
Ezra Levin, Indivisible Project. Thanks.